Yeah? Mr. Goodman?
May it please the court. My client defended himself before the jury and lost. He was allowed to do so after the district court found that he was fit to stand trial. That finding resulted from a hearing, which I don't think I'm engaging in hyperbole by characterizing that hearing as tantamount to a farce. Not a single witness testified at that hearing.
Yeah, but you know what the problem with your case is that having crazy ideas is not the same thing as being crazy. Otherwise, no tax protesters could be prosecuted. See, they get a bee in their bonnet. They say wages are not income because you have to work for them, so there's no sort of net gain. Or the 16th Amendment was unconstitutional, something like that. They get that bee in the bonnet. But often, you know, they're educated people, they're doctors, dentists, airline pilots. And I don't think insanity is even argued in those cases.
Well,
and yet what you say is that because I dare not use his name again, because he has this untenable interpretation of copyright law, and is extremely uncooperative, he really can't be tried.
I think it goes significantly beyond that, Your Honor. Bright, well-educated, professionally trained people are found unfit to stand trial or are found not guilty by reason of insanity with some frequency.
With some frequency? Where did you get that from?
The function of the clinical psychologist or of the psychiatrist is to evaluate the person as he or she presents himself and to consider that person's education, professional experience, behavior, demeanor, and so forth. But here, we didn't even get to that point. There was no hearing in any meaningful sense. The prosecution, the defense, the judge.
What was there to hear?
Well, everybody.
No evidence that he was unable to stand trial, other than the fact that he has this bizarre view about copyright law and he was uncooperative. That appears to be a widely held bizarre view, that people the judge removed from the courtroom started yelling out, "You can't do that, I'm a secured party." Right? The same ideation. And it's very difficult to say that everybody who professes this odd view is incompetent.
And the argument is not that professing such an odd view results in the axiomatic conclusion that one is incompetent.
But there's nothing else that suggests that this man is incompetent to stand trial.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. Everybody at the quote-unquote hearing...
Does Bobby feel incompetent to be tried?
Your Honor, I'm forced to admit I was born in 1970, Your Honor, and I'm not intimately familiar with the Chicago 7.
That's why we have books. I think I could ask you a question about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, too.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I did say intimately familiar with the Chicago 7 trial. I am aware that it occurred. But returning to the point about whether there is any evidence of incompetence, the psychiatrist, Greenstein, who the judge and all the lawyers involved deferred to his report as if his report definitively settled the question.
My question is serious. There are lots of people who refuse to collaborate with criminal trials, often because they want to make a political point like Bobby Seale and they don't care about the merits of the case, or often because they know they're guilty and they're going to be convicted and they just like acting out. Your position seems to be that all of these people are incompetent to stand trial. They can't be ordered to cooperate with the psychiatrist, right? This man was already referred for an inquiry and refused to cooperate. So if they refuse to cooperate with the psychiatrist and there's therefore no evidence that could be put on at a hearing, they just can't be tried. And I'm trying to figure out whether that could possibly be a proper understanding of the relation between the defendant and the court.
None of those things are the position that's espoused in the brief. The position that's espoused in the brief is that the clinical psychologist Greenstein applied incorrect presumptions and standards. His report is itself ambivalent and equivocates. He seemed to believe that his task was to find Mr. James and I competent unless he was certain, unless he had metaphysical certitude that Mr. James was in fact incompetent. That is not the presumption that is applied by federal law. I don't have any clinical training. I'm primarily an insurance lawyer. But it seems to me that there was sufficient evidence when one couples the psychologist Greenstein's ambivalence and his application of the wrong standard, that there is sufficient evidence to, based on Mr. James's behavior at the pretrial hearings that resulted in his referral, as a result of his behavior at the trial and his behavior at the disposition, to cause one to wonder whether he was in fact fit to stand trial. And the application of incorrect legal standards suggests that there should be a retrospective fitness hearing at which evidence is taken and at which the proper standards are applied. And
but
whether
why,
one can generalize...
Why wasn't it possible for Dr. Greenstein to make an assessment of Mr. James's competency even without his cooperation? In other words, he observed him. He observed his behavior. He held interviews with Mr. James's sister. He held interviews with the Moorish counselor. Why wouldn't, you know, that be enough?
Perhaps it was. The problem with Greenstein's report is that it applies an incorrect presumption, and the district court adopted that incorrect presumption. And had Greenstein testified and been challenged about his application of the incorrect presumption, or had he applied the proper presumption, given his ambivalence, given the equipoise or the uncertainty expressed in his report, it's quite possible that James would have been found unfit to stand trial. The government basically almost concedes that improper procedures were applied. They rely largely in their argument on waiver and the argument that Mr. James, it's a harmless error because the evidence of Mr. James' competence was so overwhelming. And I don't think that's a fair reading of the record. Whether you can say generally that any person who has unorthodox beliefs or who causes trouble in the district court should be subjected to a fitness examination or not, whether they should be considered to be unfit to stand trial or not, the fact remains that the district court was persuaded by the federal public defender to refer Mr. James for a psychological examination. That examination was defective, and no one noticed that. And waiver doesn't apply. If one operates from the assumption that Mr. James is in fact unfit to stand trial, he can't be taxed for the possible deficiencies of his court-appointed counsel or of the district court.
Let me take you somewhere else. Has Mr. James ever expressed a desire to wear a religious head covering while in Judge Regan's courtroom?
I do not believe there is such a statement on the record. I was appointed as appellate counsel. Mr. James rebuffed my efforts to meet with him, interview him in person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware of any reference to that on the record. Mr. Matthew, who tried the case for the government, perhaps can speak to that with greater certitude.
Now, is there some relation between the Moorish Americans and their theories and his copyright position?
I think there may be. I think there is certain indications in the record that at least some, if not necessarily the copyright position specifically, that some of the other unorthodox arguments that Mr. James advanced, the Moorish treaty and the,
right,
the not recognizing the authority of the United States and so forth, that at least some of those ideas may be held by at least some percentage of the members of this religious organization, if not are actually tenets of the religious belief. I think that I just want to briefly address the sentencing point. Even if the Fifth Circuit held in Greer that even if someone is fit to stand trial, that it should that doesn't necessarily mean that they're fully responsible for all of their actions. And encompassed within the concept of willfully obstructing justice is the notion that you're doing it on purpose. And if you think your conduct is privileged, you're not engaging in willful obstruction of justice. So someone who takes the Fifth Amendment, privileged conduct, not obstructing justice. If Mr. James legitimately believed that his conduct was privileged in serving these frivolous liens, then that is not constituted obstruction of justice. And then turning to the third point, I don't think there's any justification whatsoever for the district court's rule barring anyone in the courtroom from wearing headgear for religious purposes. And I don't think
no one who was barred from wearing headgear is a party to this case.
I don't believe that matters, Your Honor. This court has the inherent authority to review.
Wait, isn't that just the definition of an advisory opinion, that you go around declaring the rights or non-rights of non-parties?
Well, my time has expired.
There were a dispute between James and the government about whether he could wear religious headgear. One could understand this as a live case.
I think that a party has a protected associational interest in a public hearing, in having his or her supporters, his or her community attend the case. I think that the judge's prophylactic announcement at the first hearing, when Mr. James was presumably wearing an orange jumpsuit or whatever, however he was dressed by the jailers, that this would not be tolerated by the district court under any circumstances, precluded Mr. James from dressing as he saw fit.
Defendants usually wear regular clothes. They're not, when they're being tried,
Correct. So, but the announcement at the initial hearing that the district court would not tolerate this would have made it contemptuous for Mr. James to have dressed in this fashion when he defended himself at trial and presumably was allowed to dress as he saw fit before the jury.
Could have requested to wear headgear, and the judge presumably would have said no, and then we might have had a dispute, but he didn't.
I think, Your Honor, that both because the prophylactic announcement governs the subsequent events, because we're seeking subsequent proceedings where Mr. James might seek to represent himself pro se, as he might be allowed to do under certain circumstances in the district court, and inherent in this court's general authority to supervise the conduct of the district courts, I think each of those three reasons provides more than adequate warrant for this court to disavow the district court procedure.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Goodman. Mr. Massey? Yeah, let me ask you before you get started. Why couldn't the judge have defused this business by referring to him as a secured party? I mean, you could say to the jury, this defendant, for obscure reasons, would prefer to be referred to as the secured party rather than by his name. What difference would that make in a trial?
Wouldn't have made any difference to the government.
Didn't he want to be referred to by his name? He just wanted the judge to pay $500,000 every time his name was used.
$151 million. Yes.
But if he was called secured party, there would be no fee.
We didn't get to that point, Your Honor. Quite honestly, it wouldn't have mattered to the government.
He didn't argue that.
No,
sir. He wanted to be referred to as...
He didn't indicate what his preference was.
You know...
His preference was not to be present in the courtroom.
Judge Reagan didn't seem too concerned that he had rung up $151 million in claimed usage fees for using Mr. James's name in court. Are we really meant to believe that anyone, and particularly people in the law enforcement field, would be intimidated by a letter saying they would be billed $500,000 every time they used the defendant's name?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that you need to be aware of some circumstances that have happened not too long recently in the state court in Madison County, Illinois, which is one county north of St. Clair County, where a group similar to this did, in fact, place liens on the property of law enforcement officers and court personnel. In a case that was not exactly like this, but was similar. Now, bottom line, did those liens have any lasting effect? No. Were they removed from the property? Yes. Was there a process in which time and energy was spent to make sure that that property had clean titles? Yes. So can we say that lawyers, that Judge Reagan was concerned that he was going to have to pay $151 million?
But did he?
I don't think so.
Did the defendant threaten to file liens?
The defendant filed documents that he entitled liens.
He did.
He at least served them on the different parties.
But these are law enforcement people. They know what a real lien looks like. These were, you know, crude, hand-drawn lien.
No, they weren't. They were typed. They appeared to be professional. And I assume that we're talking about the second issue in this case,
the enhancement for
obstruction. And I would focus on that because I don't think the obstruction enhancement was based upon the service of a demand on Judge Reagan for $151 million any more than it was based on a demand to me for $21 million or defense counsel for $23 million.
How did you get away with using his name so rarely?
I avoided it as often as possible.
Right, prudently.
What did you do? Say things like him?
I said the defendant. Your Honor, I think the obstruction enhancement was based not on the delivery to court personnel, but on the delivery to potential government witnesses, not all of whom were police officers. There were lab personnel as well. And I think the very important thing to remember on the enhancement issue was the timing of the service of many of those documents. A jury was selected on Monday of that week. At the conclusion of that first day in trial, when the jury had been selected, when there was a pretty clear indication of the order of the government's witnesses and the identity of the government's witnesses, many of those witnesses were served with documents demanding payment, including non-police officer witnesses. It caused them, and quite frankly, it caused some of the police officers involved to at least forward the documents to their legal counsel.
Well, you would always do that no matter what you receive. Let me ask you this. Mr. James was seemed unable to cooperate with either the psychologist or counsel. By presuming that he is competent and leaving the burden on him to prove otherwise, aren't you imposing a burden on him to prove his own incompetence when, in fact, it might be that very same incompetence which renders him incapable of sustaining that burden? In other words, what do you do about a defendant who is simply too incompetent to prove that he's incompetent?
I don't think we relied on the defendant to prove his competence in this case, Your Honor.
Oh, I think the burden was placed on him here.
I would suggest that the burden was never an issue because we didn't have an issue before the court. The government, the defendant, defense attorney all agreed that there was no question as to this defendant's competence. I think in answer to your question, Judge, the answer is that you rely on the district court. Anyone who was there had no question that this defendant was unable to cooperate. This defendant chose not to cooperate with his psychologist, and there was no question about that. And I would indicate that position of not cooperating with his psychologist was really pretty consistent with his position that the district court didn't have jurisdiction over him anyway. So since the court appointed the psychologist, it didn't have jurisdiction to do that, and he wasn't going to cooperate with him any more than he did with the judge.
Mr. Massey, you are a very experienced attorney and, well, you are. And I am certain that you've appeared before Judge O'Regan a number of times.
Yes, sir.
And I have to tell you, I've been a federal judge for 19 years, and I am shocked by that transcript in which he states that if the Pope came into his courtroom, he would remove his mitre. That if a Orthodox rabbi came into his courtroom, he would remove his skull cap.
Your Honor, I understand the court's concern about that. And my only response was that the government was not involved in that. We were not asked for a position. We did not initiate
but
that
situation.
But isn't
it the government's responsibility to respond to something like that?
I
understand the sensitivity. Believe me, I do. But my goodness.
I think perhaps it definitely would have been had the defendant been involved. But the defendant, no party in this case, was involved.
Well, what do you think of the no headgear rule? Is this? It's not just religious headgear, right? No, no one can wear anything.
Apparently,
you can't
with
wear a baseball hat or anything.
I've not tried that, but with the exception of a scarf for someone undergoing chemotherapy, it would appear that there would be no headgear.
That means
the general rule that he applies to.
It's never come up in any case in which I've appeared before Judge Wright.
What kind of headdresses were these people wearing? Were they something exotic? Or
yeah, thank you.
Yes. No, they weren't.
What were they?
It's difficult to describe. It appeared to be some sort of national gear. It was not a fez as we would normally presume, because there were both male and female spectators with different types of headgear. They were tall, they were large, they were easily noticed. I mean, that they stood out, they were extremely tall, and behind that they're very...
They were obstructing other spectators' view?
My back was to them, but yes, certainly they could have some of the headgear that I saw.
But it wouldn't have mattered if it had been a skull cap. And my point is that an assistant U.S. attorney or a lawyer who happens to be an Orthodox Jew cannot come into that courtroom without violating the deepest religious principles that they hold. And that's what I find shocking.
Your Honor, I think that perhaps Judge Reagan spoke in terms beyond what he indicated in response to outbursts from spectators. Judge Reagan acted, I think, very appropriately in all of the hearings in this case. He bent over backwards to protect the defendant's rights. And you must remember...
Yes, but the headgear rule doesn't sound very sensible, because if people are wearing headgear for religious reasons, that doesn't manifest disrespect for the court.
And I don't have any disagreement with that, Your Honor. But what I am saying is that in this case, there's no party that was affected.
No, we know that.
We know that.
By that. And certainly the fairness of these proceedings, both pretrial and trial and sentencing, were certainly not affected.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Massey. And thank you to Mr. Goodman. Your time has expired. And we thank you for accepting the appointment and defending your client's vigor. Okay.